Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I am so happy to be with all of you here today. I'm actually recording today from up in Vermont, where the new GMO labeling bill has taken effect just a few days ago. And it's really exciting. Of course, there are so many people lobbying to try to reverse this law. Vermont is the first state to have mandatory labeling of GMOs. And, you know, I've looked at some of the logos that it says on the cans and or boxes, and it just says produced with genetically engineered products for more information, and then it gives the website of the product usually. Or if it doesn't have GMOs, there's a GMO circle, you know, with a slash through it, like for non-GMO. But anyway, either way, it's really exciting, but there's a lot of people working really hard to lobby to try to take that right of states away, and that's called the DARC Act. And I have a petition on my website for all of you to sign, and I'm going to ask all of you to really do that. It's really important that we all take responsibility to become active citizens, to do what we can to stand behind what we believe in. We cannot depend on our government agencies and corporations to do that for us. They have the money to do the opposite. And so we really need to band together, educate people, let people know what it means to have transparency in the foods we eat, and how much we have a right to know what is in our food. And so the only way we're going to do that is to have these labels. You know, I'd love to see our government, you know, make GMOs illegal to start with, but that's certainly not happening. So the best we can do is to hope for labeling. And I'm really thrilled to be here in Vermont witnessing that. Of course, that's not why I'm here. I'm here actually for a wedding, so I'm very excited. But I'm thrilled to be here with all of you. My guest today will be Amanda O'Born. She is the Vice President of Food and Farms at EcoTrust. And EcoTrust is a wonderful nonprofit organization in the Portland, Oregon area. And I'm going to let her tell us more about that when she comes on in just a few minutes. First, I want to share some other things going on in the news and some events going on in and around the New York area. And, of course, share a recipe with you. So in addition to the DARC Act and signing a petition to prevent that, there's also a petition to ask your representatives to pass the Water Act. The Water Act is, again, transparency and safety measure to make a commitment to safe drinking water for everybody. And right now our water system and the infrastructures are so old, whether it's lead pipes or rust or whatever, we really need to put some money into that system and make it a good one. And then the last petition that I'd like you to sign is to let Tyson know to stop polluting our water. Tyson is, you know, a huge company that has been dumping contaminants into our waterways for years. And I think they dumped 104 million pounds of pollutants into the water between 2010 and 2014. And this has just got to stop. It's not okay. They've dumped more than Exxon, DuPont, and Coke Industries all together. So we need to sign a petition and let them know that that's not okay with us. Also, I want to share with all of you that I was interviewed on an internet TV show called Life Out Loud with Junie Moon. And you can find a link to that also on my website. But it was great. It was nice to just have a casual discussion about connecting the dots. And that's what was the focus of our interview. How the foods we eat and the foods we purchase and how everything we purchase is all connected to our economy, to our health, to our environment, and the people that are behind it. And you have to really follow the money, and I've said this so many times, and it's so true. You know, our country is really run by business and corporations, and we need to put some of this power back into the people. And we can only do that if we all get involved. So I'm going to call on all of you again to really to get involved, understand how the connections of what we purchase affects things down the line, and what we can do to change that. And also just to share with you, I want to share that San Francisco has banned Styrofoam, which is a biggie. You know, as a caterer, for years people have been using Styrofoam, or every time you go into a deli and you want to get a coffee and it's in Styrofoam, not only does it change the flavor of the coffee, but you know that that Styrofoam cup is not recyclable. So this is a great ban, and I am hoping that this just sets a precedent and starts more states to follow or more cities to follow. So I want to share with you some things going on in and around our area here in New York. There's a Long Island Food Truck Rodeo going on between July 8th and the 17th out at the Southampton Elks Lodge. And you can just Google the Long Island Food Truck Rodeo and you'll find out all the specifics for that. But it's only $5 to get in or $20 for VIP, so that should be fun. Next Wednesday, July 13th, is a screening of the film Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. Vaxxed is a great film. I saw it at the Angelica Film Center months ago. Really great. It talks about the MRI vaccination. It is not an anti-vaccination film. It is just a film to get people to think about how many vaccinations are really necessary, what are the implications, what are the reactions that happen, and what are the cover-ups. Again, when you connect the dots and you really follow the money, you see the money that is involved in vaccinations, the amount of money that these pharmaceutical companies make, the amount of money that doctors make, the amount of money that drug companies make or that, you know, that pharmacies make. It's just unbelievable. And they're trying to say that there were no side effects from this MMR vaccination when clearly you have parent after parent after parent sharing their experience with how their normal child became not normal after having this vaccination. And you can't have all these parents just making up a story. So there's a lot of truth to this film, and there's a lot of food for thought. I'm not, you know, 100% anti-vaccination by any stretch, but I am someone who thinks that vaccinating our kids is 30 vaccinations. With vaccinations, you can, there's no way to test how the different vaccinations interact with each other. They can test a vaccination all by itself, but how can they test how it reacts in someone's body with other vaccinations being given at the same time? It's just impossible. And so you really need to rethink it. I remember when my kids were going off to college and they wanted to vaccinate them for meningitis, I believe. I think that's what was going around. And when I looked at the statistics of the implications or the reactions and negative reactions that people could have from the vaccination versus getting the disease, it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous to vaccinate a whole population of people for the small chance that someone might get the disease. It just didn't make sense when the reaction from the vaccination was greater than the detriment from the disease. So really food for thought. But anyway, if you can, Wednesday, July 13th at the Cinema Arts Center at 7:30, come out to see the documentary Vaxxed. Saturday, July 16th, there's a Native Garden Tour. This is being sponsored by the North Shore Land Alliance. It's also being sponsored by the Sierra Club, and it's at the home of the Barefoot Gardener out in West Hampton. So you can go to the North Shore Land Alliance website to find out about that. They're also having a summer sunset on the bay potluck in Sag Harbor. So check that out as well. Monday, July 18th, the Long Island Food Coalition, which Slow Food North Shore and IE Green are both members of, is a great organization that is just really getting going, forming after the Long Island Food Conference and the Long Island Small Farm Summits. After we did those big conferences, we realized that there's a real need and a real desire of people to come together to learn about sustainability and organic gardening, organic farming, and our food and how it's all connected. And so we have set up this trip. We are going to be taking a Hampton Jitney, actually the opposite direction of the Hamptons, to Kutztown, Pennsylvania, where the Rodale Institute is. They have over 300 acres of organic farmland, and we will do a tour of the institute as well as an organic agricultural workshop. So sign up for that. There's still room on the bus, and we really would love to fill the bus. So come on out for that. Wednesday, July 20th, is a film screening of Merchants of Doubt, and there will be a speaker, Dr. Cody Keller, following that, who is an ecologist, former naval captain, and national security expert to talk about climate change. And that's at the Massapequa Library. Farm-to-table benefit dinner to benefit Catskey Farm and the Sylvia Center's Learning Garden. That will be July 23rd. By the way, all of these events are listed on my website at ieatgreen.com. Sunday, July 24th, is the March for Clean Energy Revolution, and that's going to be taking place in front of the National Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Food and Water Watch is behind there, along with a few other nonprofit organizations. Ban fracking now, keep fossil fuels in the ground, stop dirty energy. All really good stuff. If you can make it to this, we'd really love to see a really great showing of people. And you can sign up for buses at Food and Water Watch. They're organizing buses from around the country to come to Philadelphia for this march. Tuesday, July 26th, I.E. Green, me, I am doing a Japanese farm-to-table cooking class. I have set up a series of three cooking classes. They're all vegan and gluten-free. The first one is Japanese, and that's Tuesday, July 26th. The second one is a Mediterranean farm-to-table cooking class. That's Tuesday, August 2nd. And the last one is Tuesday, August 16th, and that is a Thai farm-to-table cooking class. All of them are vegan and gluten-free. All of them will be taking place at the I.E. Green Homestead, where we will first harvest the vegetables from the organic on-site garden and then go into the kitchen and cook them up. And we will sit down for a beautiful communal dinner, either outdoors or inside, depending on the weather. So sign up for those. It's $89 for one class or $235 for all three. It's always a fun time and should be really great. So I hope to see some of you there. Thursday, July 28th, I am hosting, along with Slow Food North Shore, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. Every year she comes out to the I.E. Green Homestead and does a walk, an edible and medicinal herb walk. And this time we're also going to make some salves. So, you know, we ask everyone to bring a little jar, but she's great. Ellen Kamai is a wealth of knowledge. She knows so much about the wild plants growing. And she'll help us make some really great bio-natural creams. So sign up for that. August 12th to the 14th is NOFA's Summer Conference. That's taking place at Amherst, Massachusetts at UMass. You can find out more information about that on the NOFA website. And that's about it. More things are on my website if you do want to check them out. But before I invite Amanda O'Born on, I would like to share with you this week's recipe, which is a mushroom medley stir fry. And I realize it's not so much of a medley because I really only had lots of organic white mushrooms to put in this, but feel free to make it a medley and add portobellos or shiitakes. It would be a great addition. So I used one package of organic brown rice spaghetti, cooked al dente because it's going to finish cooking in the wok. 2 pounds of organic white mushrooms, cleaned and quartered. 1 onion cut into slivers. 2 to 3 carrots, julienned. 3 portobello mushrooms. Oh, I did have portobello mushrooms. I take that back. Portobello mushrooms. 2 8-ounce packs of tempeh cut into cubes. 1 cup of olive oil. 1/4 cup of aji marin. 1/4 cup of tamari. 2 tablespoons of dark sesame oil. 1/4 cup of peanuts, which, of course, are optional if you don't eat peanuts, 20 cloves or give or take, of garlic, chopped fine, 3 scallions, a half a bunch of broccoli, 1 cup of snow peas, a quarter to a half a teaspoon of red pepper flakes. If you like it spicy, that's optional. And a quarter cup or more of fresh parsley or cilantro. So because I don't like to wash a lot of things, I started in a wok and I, you know, saute some things, remove them, saute some other things, remove them, and then bring it all together again. So I start by sauteing the mushrooms in the wok on high heat in some olive oil with 4 cloves of garlic. And I do that until they're soft. And I cook it at a high heat so that I'm really searing the outside and caramelizing the outside of the mushrooms. Once they're cooked, take them out, wipe out the wok, and then we're going to start again. Put a little olive oil in the wok and add the carrots and the onions and cook those on high heat in the olive oil with about another 4 cloves of garlic until those are soft. Remove them from the wok. You can add them to the mushrooms. And again, wipe out the wok. Now you're going to add the tempeh cubes into the wok, again with olive oil and the garlic. And you're going to saute those until golden brown. And you really, tempeh is really delicious, especially when the outside is golden brown. So you actually have to watch as you're stir-frying these and turn the cubes over so that each side really gets be golden brown. If you would like to dirty another pan, you certainly can be sauteing the cubes of tempeh in a cast iron frying pan next to the wok, doing it simultaneously. But again, I was trying to just use one dish, so I was doing it in the wok. But you have to be a little bit more mindful to turn the tempeh when you use the wok as opposed to a flat cast iron pan. Then I added the tamari and the mirin and the dark sesame oil to the tempeh. And then I added the peanuts and I added the vegetables back into the wok. Then I added the scallions and the broccoli and cooked that for about another 3 minutes. Last, I added the snow peas so that they stay bright and green. Then I added the parsley, and I didn't have any cilantro, but you can, if you had cilantro, it would be great with that. Taste it. You can add more tamari, more sesame oil, and more mirin, depending on what you'd like. And the more you cook with these ingredients, the more you become familiar with the flavor that each one imparts. The mirin makes it a little bit sweeter. The sesame oil gives it, obviously, the flavor of sesame, and the tamari adds a little bit more salt to the dish. And that's it. Really delicious. Cooks up. It's a great midweek meal because it cooks up so fast. I find that I do a lot of the rice pastas during the week when I'm trying to cook fast. So enjoy, and let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Amanda O'Born. She's the Vice President of Food and Farms at EcoTrust. Amanda, are you with me?
I am.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Good morning. That dish sounds delicious. That might have to be lunch.
Ah, it's great. I make that for lunch, too, because I have a group of 4 interns. And, you know, again, the pasta, you know, is just bulk, and it, you know, it cooks up, and it's fast, and it's easy to feed large groups of people. So I think that's also why I'm using a lot of pasta these days. But, yeah, it's a great, easy-to-make dish. So,
sounds delicious.
Can you share with everybody that's listening a little, give us a little history about EcoTrust before we get into specifically what you do with the food and farms portion? Because when I was on the website, I was amazed at all the things that EcoTrust is actually involved in.
It is definitely a many-headed hydra.
Right.
EcoTrust is a nonprofit 501c3 based in Portland, as you mentioned off the top. It's a little confusing, however. It's not a very traditional nonprofit. We work at the intersection of conservation and commerce. So we're in the Pacific Northwest. Our region is from Northern California. We do work from roughly Northern California up through British Columbia and into Alaska. And the notion is really that in all of the sectors in which we work, which are primarily forestry and fisheries and food and farming, which are 3 obviously very key industries out here in the Pacific Northwest, we're trying to help foment a shift from a traditional industrial profit-driven model of development to one that's more ecologically based, still profitable, but takes into account the complexity and the self-organizing type systems that you see in nature, as opposed to the hierarchical, linear sort of structure, profit-only structure that you see in the industrial economy.
Right. And how do they do that? How do they do that, and why aren't more companies doing that?
That's why when you go on your website, you see so many different projects, because rather than working at the direct service end of the spectrum, we are really up at the systems level, which can mean a lot of different things. We have a whole department that's focused on GIS mapping and software tool development and data visualizations. We have a group focused on communications that's taking those maps and making them beautiful and accessible, both online and in print, and telling the stories of this bioregion, both here and around the world. And then we have three dedicated program teams, one for food and farming that, of course, we'll get into a lot more today, and then one dedicated to fisheries issues and one dedicated to forestry issues. And in some cases, that means buying forest land and converting it from a traditional industrial orchard-type management to ecological management. We've spawned a subsidiary entity that's an investment fund that does exactly that, buys forest land and converts it to ecological forestry. It could be, we have a, in our fisheries group, there's salmon recovery and salmon habitat is an enormous issue out here. Salmon are sort of the buffalo of the Pacific Northwest. They're the iconic canary in the coal mine species that lets us know how the ecology of the entire region is doing. And of course, salmon are in big trouble. The water's getting too hot. They can't get through the dams. Lots and lots of issues related to salmon. So our fisheries team is hard at work trying to remove some of those barriers, both literally and figuratively, for those poor fish. And then obviously in food and farms, we'll dig way into that, I think, today.
Great. So, yeah, so why don't we talk a little bit about the food and farms and how you're tackling some of the food system reform through EcoTrust.
Sure. You know, we have this fundamental belief that there are solutions to all of the sort of ills of our food system, whether they be nutrition or soil health or public health or economic health, that get solved if we shift our food system from one that's global industrial based to one that's regional. So in practice, that looks like the types of local food efforts that you see all over the country. And it sounds like you're in Vermont today, which of course is probably the only other place that has the kind of robust diversity of agriculture as we do here in Oregon. Really, really rich diversity of products and an eater population that cares about where their food comes from,
right,
and how it's made and what it's all about and is willing to ask questions and teach people how to cook and really dig in there. So I feel like we're in kindred spirit places this morning.
We are. Vermont, just everywhere here.
Yeah.
And we go to the farmer's market,
yeah,
and it's people, you know, go to, and the same when I went to the farmer's market in Portland. People go there to hang out. They go there for the entertainment, for their social community. You know, you meet people there. There's music there. It's a whole happening. Whereas, you know, in New York, you go to the farmer's market and there's just a few booths and, you know, it's very quiet and you just go get what you're going to get and you leave, you know. There's, I mean, of course, sometimes you run into people, and the people that do go there even for shopping are people you want to talk to, because we're usually there with a booth for slow food, so we do talk to everybody. But it's not the same hangout vibe. It's not like a place that people go for socialize.
Yeah, Vermont and Oregon, I think, are kindred spirits in that way, that food is very central to culturally how we think about, headed and what our, our politics and our cares and concerns are all manifest in our food choices. But EcoTrust doesn't work much at the farmer's market scale of things. We really are focused on a little bit bigger scale, and how do we change the food system itself, the one that puts food on the shelves of our grocery stores and the tables at our restaurants and the cafeteria trays of our major institutions, which is a particular focus for us. So changing the food system outright is reliant and builds on the work of all of the people for the last 30 years in the organics movement and in the farm-to-table movement and in the farmers market movement and the CSA movement. All of those folks have woken people up to the issues and have, as you say, created a social environment where you can see and touch and taste and smell really fresh, locally grown food and meet your farmer and really have a conversation and get that sort of emotional part of your brain triggered to be paying attention to these issues. You don't get that same kind of access or visibility or transparency in a, you know, a cafeteria. You get it a little more if you shop at a co-op, but not necessarily at a major grocery store chain. Trader Joe's is a popular one that I think people really believe is doing the right thing. And honestly, you can't tell where that stuff is coming from either, and they're very price-oriented the way they buy. So it's very deceptive. It's very confusing. And whether that's misinformation or just you know, it's so much to absorb for any individual shopper, there's not a lot of transparency in the major food system. And so our hope is to shift that whole system toward one that is more transparent, that is more restorative in terms of soil health, that is more nutritious and nutrient dense for the sake of public health, to do all of those things and to build resilience in it by focusing on creating a really high functioning, strong local food economy, one that embraces farmers markets and CSAs, but also goes well beyond right into the mainstream outlets where the vast majority of food is bought and sold in this country. So it's a very systems approach, which sometimes can feel a little wonky. We do a lot of research. We write a lot of reports. We work with a lot of federal agencies and that kind of thing. But in some cases, it's really tangible. And the project, we're building a physical food hub real estate development project here in Portland that I'm happy to talk more about if there's interest. That's one place where you'll walk right into the issues of the food system and becomes very transparent.
Yeah. You know, it's like I'm listening to you talk and I'm just thinking about, you know, for instance, a restaurant depot, you know, where, you know, their tagline is, you know, we're a restaurant shop. And, you know, I go in there, and I know I've said this before, so forgive me those that have heard this before, but I go there and I buy my latex gloves. I buy my aluminum pans. There's very little there that I can buy, very little.
Right.
You know, they do have some organic coffee, but I think that's, like, the only organic thing they have. It's just unbelievable. There's nothing. You know, all the food is GMO, artificially colored, artificially flavored, you know, has preservatives in it, everything. It's just amazing.
But bear in mind that most of your restaurant operators probably are shopping there for food.
I know.
That's the scary thing.
And,
out here
and
we have cash and carry, and it's the same idea.
And when you think of how many people eat out almost so many of their meals, at least in, you know, this New York region, so many people eat out, and they might not be eating out at fancy restaurants that do try to source their food sustainably, but most, you know, people who are eating out a lot are grabbing food at the deli and picking it up at, you know, even Whole Foods, you know, they don't use their organic stuff in their deli, you know, they use the regular stuff. So it's a hard, you know, it's really hard. So where do you start when you say, you know, you try to change the regional food system? Do you start by going to the cafeterias and the institutions saying, you know, we want you to, you know, try to find, you know, sustainable sources? Or do you go to the farmers and say you need to start, you know, raising the food that way so that we can bring you some institutions? Which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Exactly. You have put your finger right on the conundrum of where do you start, chicken or egg? You said earlier in the show that you have to follow the money. We do exactly that in our work, and we start with the buyers. And we start primarily with really, really big buyers. We have, for a dozen years, worked on farm-to-school efforts, which in its early days was a very broad-based effort to work on everything from school gardens and garden education, curriculum development, parent engagement, teacher engagement, and procurement all the way across the board, to now we've really evolved and refined our efforts to focus primarily on procurement, to funnel those school dollars, which can be incredibly substantial, directly toward food that is ideally made with restorative production practices and coming from this region. But therein you run into the problem exactly as you identified, that there isn't necessarily enough supply from local farmers to get it there. But holding on that for just a minute, use those dollars to spend in the local economy. And even if it's not the perfect production practices, most schools cannot afford organic. They can't necessarily afford 100% grass-fed meat. They can't afford some of those really premium, high production value products, which, you know, is another whole conversation about our two-tiered food system in this country. They can't do all of that, but what they can do is source from within the region. And so after a lot of years of effort working with the Oregon legislature, last year, 4.5 million, or in the last school biennium, I should say, Oregon works on a biennium system, $4.5 million was set aside out of the Oregon legislature specifically to supplement public schools, K-12 public schools, food budgets, so that that incremental money could be spent on locally produced or processed products, which we know from research that we did back in about 2010, 2011, makes an absolutely enormous difference on the local economic development. So for every dollar spent on local food by a school, $2 of economic activity is created in the regional economy. It's a huge number. A 2.0 mm-hmm. multiplier is enormous. It really shows how far your dollars can go when you spend them in your local economy. So that's creating jobs in the region. It's creating, obviously, those kids are also getting better food, we hope. We hope that that money isn't just going toward stuff that's processed in Oregon, but actually grown. And we know that a lot of it is really going to farmers in our region, not just to processors. So that was a really huge, really exciting win.
Yeah, absolutely. But then what do we do about, like, our governmental policy that, you know, that requires schools to take commodity foods, which is all the garbage food that nobody else wants, that they give to the schools almost for free and that schools must use, right? So what do the schools then do with all those commodity products?
Well, the school food service directors that we've worked with out here have been very strategic about the commodity foods program. So they use it for some basic ingredients, some cheese and some of the basic things that they know that they're going to need. But then if they've got access to scratch cooking kitchens, they're using those as ingredients in more healthful options. So they're really resisting the pressure to buy or take the highly, highly processed finished foods that come through that system and really focus on the things that they can use as ingredients. And at the same time, there's a parallel effort. EcoTrust isn't a lobbyist, doesn't do advocacy, but there is an enormous movement to help change the regulatory context in which our food system operates, and right. That's a big one.
Right. Now, you said $4.5 million is in your local budget to supplement the school lunch. Do you know what is the budget for school lunch? Like, I'm just trying to figure out, $4.5 million sounds like a lot, but what percentage of the budget?
Well, I think that I can't remember off the top of my head. I want to say it's about $1.18 per student per meal. But just to give you a comparison, Oregon now spends $4.5 million to supplement budgets for local food. The federal government only allocates $5 million across the country to do the same thing. So wow. Oregon has been hugely progressive on this particular front. However, we've just been talking within our team that money doesn't automatically renew. It's going to come up for a vote again in the next legislative session. And right now there isn't funding to support the advocacy that's required to keep this top of mind, to do the evaluation, to share the impacts, to walk legislators through the lunchrooms and have them really see the impact of what they're doing. So this, you know, that funding is, in very tight economic times, is always at risk. So this is something that we'll be redoubling our efforts on over the next year and a half, is to find the funding, to do the evaluation research, to demonstrate and share the impact of that funding so that it gets renewed. So EcoTrust is hosting a big convening in October 26th, in the evening at the EcoTrust building in Portland, that will be the farm to school stakeholders from around this region to have a conversation about what the next phase of the farm to school movement looks like. Like so many other things, it's kind of plateaued. There was a lot of interest and a lot of gritty work made by a lot of people who are real movers and shakers and innovators in the farm to table movement writ large, really focused their energies on farm to school for 10 or 15 years and made a lot of wins and a lot of successes. And now a lot of that energy has kind of plateaued. And so one of the big questions for us, in addition to this particular funding question and the renewal of this funding in Oregon, is just at a much bigger scale, what does the next phase of the movement really look like? Who's going to be involved? How do you take it all to the next level? And I think those conversations are happening regionally across the country, and then also with School Food Focus and with the National Farm to School Network. I think this is a big question on everyone's mind.
Yeah. I mean, Michelle Obama was so involved in, you know, the school food, you know, with the Let's Move program, but it was also about the food that they were eating, not just moving. And I don't know if I'm sure you noticed, you know, as time went on, it became less about the food and more about just moving, because she got such pushback from all the lobbyists of, you know, the frozen pizza people, the frozen French fry people, you know, and they...
Food is a very political issue.
Yeah, that's to say the least. Yeah, it really is.
She's been an incredible advocate, though, and I think there's a lot of
ag in the middle. I'm sorry, what's that?
Yeah. Oh, I was just saying,
I wanted to take a couple. We keep doing that. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'll stop.
Okay. I just wanted to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about ag of the middle. I know you write about that a bit, and I want to just, you know, give people an opportunity to know what that is and why it's important. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Amanda Oborn from Food and Farms at EcoTrust, and I'm Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Amanda Oborn. She's the VP at Food and Farms at EcoTrust. Amanda, are you with me?
I am.
Great. So right before the break, I wanted to ask you about ag of the middle, which is what you write about a lot. Can you explain what that is and why it's important?
Yeah, that term was coined by Fred Kirschenman and a group from the Leopold Center, who was looking into issues of essentially saving the family farm and what has happened to American agriculture over the last 40 years or so. And the basic concept is that there's been so much corporate consolidation in agriculture that you know, we all, those of us who are of a certain age, lived through the bankruptcy of many small family farms and watched them sell into their neighbors or to consolidated corporate interest. So we have a bunch of really, really enormous farms, both in the Midwest and in the Central Valley of California and across the country. Really, there are really significant large farms that are run essentially as corporations. And then there's been this resurgence, as we were just talking about, of very, very small, diversified, mixed vegetable and organic farms, that tend to be very, very small acreage and run in a completely different way. So there's fairly robust growth at the small end of the spectrum and continues to be growth at the large end of the spectrum. But that mid-scale size farm, or what we call the ag of the middle, is what has disappeared over the last 40 years. And I have a working hypothesis that it's that scale of farm that would really serve a regional food system very well. The general notion is that ag of the middle are those farms that are too big. It's sort of a conceptual construct. It's not defined by a specific gross sales or acreage number. But it's essentially the notion that they're the farms too big to sell at farmers markets, but too small to sell into the commodity chain. Although I think of them as the farms that carry local values but operate at wholesale volumes. So they're the ones that have enough production to be a meaningful player in a wholesale supply chain, serving food to a hospital or a school or a corporate cafeteria or an assisted living center, but not so big that they are all about, nothing but economies of scale and profitability and efficiency. In other words, the motivators that drive the kinds of decisions that tend to be destructive to soil health and to nutritional content, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our work sort of centers around how do we rebuild that ag of the middle in this region? In some cases that looks like helping them do market development. So we've learned that a lot of these farmers are maybe small or just growing, and they have a real passion for the cultivation practices, but may or may not know much or have dedicated staff working on market development and marketing and branding and strategy and all of the sales and all of that kind of buyer-focused activity. And that's someplace where EcoTrust has a lot of experience, a lot of background, making those market connections and facilitating those buyer relationships. So that's, mm-hmm. we do a lot of that kind of work for particular producers and for the body of Northwest regional producers as a whole.
Uh-huh. And are you seeing the results? Are you seeing those come back and the ag of the middle start to come back and get stronger? Or is it still a ways off?
Well, the trend is still the other way, right? So the forces at play are enormous. The broad trend is still the other way, but we are seeing lots and lots and lots of bright spots. There's lots of reasons for hope. We've worked with some really fantastic individual producers. Carmen Ranch is a grass-fed beef producer that's been cultivating a farmer's market following for years and a whole cow subscription program for years, and is now, getting to a point where they've really got a robust clientele here in Portland, and they're going to be using the aggregation and storage, cold storage space in that new real estate development food hub that we're working on, and really expanding their distribution over the next couple years. So there are some great bright spots out there. I think it's work well worth doing, but we're not seeing the kind of, wholesale change yet.
Right. Yeah, because I think, at least, what I've seen here on Long Island, where I live, the smaller farmers, who could grow bigger, don't necessarily want to. I know there was a food hub type of thing built, a place where they could have cold storage and extra refrigeration and freezer space for added value products, things of that, and the buy-in has been really slow and almost non-existent. I think the people behind it, the funding of it, Suffolk County, and I think they've been really surprised and disappointed, but, the farmers don't really want to participate. They're really happy with the business model that they have and they're not necessarily looking to get bigger.
It's a known quantity, right? I mean, when you've got something that's working, then making a radical shift like that and changing your clientele is a huge risk. So
right.
it's part of the work incumbent on facilitating this kind of transformation is to de-risk the deal for everybody involved as we go along. So mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time in the first segment talking about farm to school, and really our strategy on farm to school has grown to encompass institutions of all kinds for two reasons. One, because they have enormous procurement budgets, and even, you know, at an $8 million food procurement budget, even a percentage point or two shift in that spending from the commodity system to local food has enormous implications, both economically and for any individual farmer participating in that supply chain. So one is the purchasing power of institutions and how dramatically they can make a difference relative to any one of our individual spending.
You're talking about like hospitals and corporate cafeterias and that kind of thing.
Yep, and assisted living centers and event mm-hmm. venues, any sort of food service operation.
Right.
The other reason that I think institutions are really important, and this is definitely true in farm to school, but it's true in lots of other arenas also, is that the people that are eating, both as clients, whether they're students or patients or inmates or, you know, what have you, either as clients or as staff, who work at that facility, who work at that hospital, who eat in that hospital cafeteria for their lunch during their shift, those tend to be folks who are not shopping at Whole Foods Market or, the high-end farm-to-table type grocery retailers. They mm-hmm. are the folks who are, you know, very much working middle-class people who don't have access to this kind of great food because of the price. So if we shift the way institutions source their food, then we create affordability and access for enormous swaths of the population that wouldn't otherwise have it. I think of institutions as sort of a direct delivery vehicle for nutrient-dense, fresh local food. And so for both the social impact reason and the economic driver reason, I think institutions can play a really important role in galvanizing a shift in the food system writ large.
Uh-huh.
So we're focused at that level, but understanding that they can't take, big institutions can't take 147 farmers showing up in their pickup trucks and their box trucks and their Subarus all day long. And they can't take, you know, bunches of carrots with dirt still on them right out of the ground, like is acceptable in a farmer's market setting. So there has to be some aggregation and some processing and some storage and some,
right.
Carrots have to be peeled and sliced and diced, and onions and potatoes and all that kind of stuff requires some processing first. So that's really the motivation behind focusing on that physical infrastructure and those physical food hubs, as you were mentioning, in Suffolk County.
Right. Well, that goes to my next question. I know when we had met last spring at Food Tank, we talked about the project you're doing called, is it pronounced RED?
Yes, the RED.
R-E-D-D. That's going to be like a local food hub, right, of all of these mid-sized and small farmers to do some of that processing, right? Can you share with us how that project's going? And
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the RED is the name for where salmon, R-E-D-D is the name of the little nest in the gravel where salmon lay their eggs. And because of EcoTrust's fisheries history and the fact that this building sits on Salmon Street, that's how the name came about. It's the RED on Salmon Street. And it's also a nice metaphor for the sort of incubation function that will happen on this campus. It's two buildings. It's two city blocks, two full city blocks right in the heart of the Central East Side Industrial District of Portland, which is a very up-and-coming neighborhood. It has a long history of food distribution. It's where all the truck farmers from out in the countryside used to bring their produce in, and it would get redistributed around the city, essentially from that neighborhood. And then it became a very industrial neighborhood. It still was home to many food distributors and warehouses. And then more recently, it's going through a period of really rapid gentrification. And a lot of that industrial, sort of iconic industrial warehouse space is getting converted to fancy condos and office space for tech companies and web design firms and that kind of thing. And so EcoTrust managed to get a hold of two city blocks and intends to hold them in productive use as industrial spaces really devoted to the food system. There will be both the aggregation, processing, distribution functions of a physical food hub, much like you've seen in other places around the country. But then there's also a sort of layered in a notion that if we're going to find the solutions to our food system issues, it's really going to take long-term collaboration by a diverse mix of people who all have their heads in that particular game, the food system reform game, but are coming at it from different perspectives and in different ways. So on the one hand, you've got Beeline Sustainable Transport, which is our anchor tenant that's managing all the warehousing and doing the last mile distribution by truck tricycle, no less. And these are essentially great big trikes that have a cargo trailer on the back of them that can take up to an 800-pound payload and distribute food all over the city out of these trikes.
And one person is going to pedal that?
Yeah, they've got an electric assist to help them get over some of the hills.
Oh, they do. Okay, good.
But yeah, it's almost entirely people power.
Wow.
And they can move a breathtaking amount of food in those little trikes. It's a very deceptive model. And of course, it doesn't clog streets or docks, and it doesn't generate any pollution. It's really an incredible system. So we've got those guys sitting right next to the new national headquarters of Food Corps, which is the school garden curriculum education.
Great.
It's like the AmeriCorps program where they place recent college graduates in schools around the country to help cultivate school garden curriculum education. Those guys, and of course Deb Eschenmeyer, who's the replaced Sam Cass as the First Lady's food czar. I can't remember what the exact title is, but she was a co-founder of Food Corps along with Kurt Ellis and the rest of their team. And so those guys are moving their national headquarters into the red space this fall. So we've got Beeline next to Food Corps, and then we have three commissary kitchens. And then in the second building will be restaurants and retail and office space, all cultivated and curated in a way that attracts the mix of tenants and folks who are all very interested in seeing a different kind of food system and working on it in their own unique way.
It's not only being built as a commercial space for people in the industry, but it's also open to the public to come and to, you know, like you said, there's restaurants and people can shop there. And so it's a multi-use space.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. And there's a parking lot that's being landscaped between the two buildings that will be suitable for food festivals and farmers markets. And my hope is that we'll actually have a food cart pod out there where the food carts are all, you know, sourcing from mid-sized farmers and ranchers and fishermen in our region. I think it's going to be a really exciting public space. And I think it's the first phase will open this early. Well, technically it'll be open the end of this month, but the tenants won't really be moved in until early this fall. So phase one opens very soon. And then we'll start construction on and redevelopment of the big space, the more public-facing space, at the beginning of 2017, and it'll take about a year and a half to finish. So by early 2018, we should be fully operational.
Wow, that's going to be great. Very excited. I'd love to see that in more places because I think that's the key, to have that place with the infrastructure, with the places where people can do everything under one roof, from the, getting the product in to processing it, to cleaning it, to doing whatever they need to do, and then, of course, marketing it. But we're just about out of time, so why don't you share with everybody, before we run out of time, the EcoTrust website, and if they have any other questions,
how
they can get in touch.
Yeah. The EcoTrust website is www.ecotrust.org. That one's pretty straightforward. We're all on Twitter. There's a Twitter handle for Red on Salmon Street. There's one for EcoTrust, just EcoTrust. And then mine is A.O. Born, easy to find me. And I would be more than happy to answer questions or direct you to the right folks internally who can answer questions. And we'd love to see more of these kinds of efforts take hold around the country. I know there's a lot of people digging in on these issues there in Vermont and also in New York and all over the place. So always happy to connect with like-minded folks around the country.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for joining me today on the show. It's really exciting what's going on. Thrilled to learn about it. I can't wait to come back out and visit it.
Yes, please do. And thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Everyone who's listening, thanks for joining us. I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.